Here's one more item for you, the last in our civics book, rights. Boy, everyone in this country is always running around yammering about their fucking rights. I have a right, you have no right, we have a right, they don't have a right. Folks, I hate to spoil your fun, but there's no such thing as rights, okay? They're imaginary. We made them up, like the boogeyman. The three little pigs, Pinocchio, Mother Goose, shit like that. Rights are an idea. They're just imaginary. They're a cute idea. Cute. But that's all. Cute and fictional. But if you think you do have rights, let me ask you this. Where do they come from? People say, well, they come from God. They're God-given rights. Oh, fuck. Here we go again. Here we go again. The God excuse. The last refuge of a man with no answers and no argument. It came from God. Anything we can't describe must have come from God. Personally, folks, I believe that if your rights came from God, he would have given you the right to some food every day, and he would have given you the right to a roof over your head. God would have been looking out for you. God would have been looking out for you. You know that? He wouldn't have been worried about making sure you have a gun so you get drunk on Sunday night and kill your girlfriend's parents. But let's say it's true. Let's say God gave us these rights. Why would he give us a certain number of rights? The Bill of Rights in this country has 10 stipulations, okay? 10 rights. And apparently God was doing sloppy work that week because we've had to amend the Bill of Rights an additional 17 times. So God forgot a couple of things, like slavery. Just fucking slipped his mind. But let's say God gave us the original 10. He gave the British 13. The British Bill of Rights has 13 stipulations. The Germans have 29. The Belgians have 25. The Swedish have only 6. And some people in the world have no rights at all. What kind of a fucking goddamn God-given deal is that? No rights at all? Why would God give different people in different countries different numbers of different rights? Boredom? Amusement? Bad arithmetic? Do we find out at long last, after all this time, that God is weak in math skills? Doesn't sound like divine planning to me. Sounds more like human planning. Sounds more like one group trying to control another group. In other words, business as usual in America. Now, if you think you do have rights, one last assignment for you. Next time you're at the computer, get on the internet, go to Wikipedia. When you get to Wikipedia, in the search field for Wikipedia, I want you to type in Japanese Americans 1942, and you'll find out all about your precious fucking rights, okay? All right. You know about it. You know about it. Yeah. In 1942, there were 110,000 Japanese American citizens in good standing, law-abiding people who were thrown into internment camps simply because their parents were born in the wrong country. That's all they did wrong. They had no right to a lawyer, no right to a fair trial, no right to a jury of their peers, no right to due process of any kind. The only right they had, right this way, into the internment camps. Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone can take them away. They're privileges. That's all we've ever had in this country is a bill of temporary privileges. And if you read the news even badly, you know that every year the list gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You see how soon it is? Yeah. Sooner or later, the people in this country are going to realize the government does not give a fuck about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a fuck about you. It's interested in its own power. That's the only thing, keeping it and expanding it wherever possible. Personally, when it comes to rights, I think one of two things is true. I think either we have unlimited rights or we have no rights at all. Personally, I lean toward unlimited rights. I feel, for instance, I have the right to do anything I please. But if I do something you don't like, I think you have the right to kill me. So where are you going to find a fairer fucking deal than that? So the next time some asshole says to you, I have a right to my opinion, you say, oh yeah, well I have a right to my opinion, and my opinion is you have no right to your opinion. Then shoot the fuck and walk away. Thank you.
Well, it makes sense to me. Damn good sense, as far as I'm concerned. I hope you feel the same way when they try to bullshit you about your rights and giving rights and taking rights and all that kind of stuff. Like he said, and I've said for years, you have privileges. And you have them as long as you do what somebody with power wants you to do. As long as you follow all the rules that the ruling class lay down, you have privileges. If you screw up, bye-bye, privileges, bye-bye. Of course, you might say we have natural rights by nature that we can rise up with a baseball bat and go after them. We can light the torches and pick up the pitchforks and the sawed-off shotguns, and that's your right, until they catch you, and then they're going to kill you, unless you kill them first. It all boils down to that shit. White Aryan Resistance calling, White Aryan Resistance radio calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy, who tend to piss off everybody I can. If I don't offend you enough on one of these shows I put on, just keep tuning in and I'll figure some way to offend you. Because most people need offending. I get offended every day, every time I walk down the main street of this town, or any town, and look around at the garbage that's around, human and natural. People throwing shit out the windows of their cars, and they'd probably throw their babies out the window if they get away with it. So anyhow, we all get offended, and we either have to put up with it or stop it, you know? I spend a lot of my time trying to offend politicians. I love to get in their face, you know? We have a Friday night get-together down here in the town during the summer, and there's always guys running for office and stuff, and church booze, and I walk up, and I also do this at the county fair and drive them crazy. I love to walk up to the Christian booths and say, well, I'm an atheist. What do you think? And watch their eyeballs get big. They're not used to that around here. They're not used to anybody being flat out, straight out, say, I'm a white racist atheist. Now what you gonna say? Love it, baby. Love it, baby. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations and your snail mail. Anything you want us to pass on to a POW, let us know and we'll do it for you. And that reminds me, I got to pick up some money orders. I must be honest with you, and honesty gets me in trouble a lot of times, but I sleep good at night. I'm a little concerned with the Matt Hale situation because his mother's in charge of trying to help him, and of course that's a good thing for her to do, because most mothers would walk away. But she's getting him in touch and on these radio shows by these, I don't know, I guess you could call them sort of right-wingers and sort of racist and sort of NS and sort of Hitler lovers and this and that, but they're scared as hell for real to really come out swinging. And in fact, most of these guys, these shows, you know who they are. If you say nigger on the show, they'd run a mile. But his mother is getting him on some of these shows of people who can't stand what we believe. Most of these people have these shows, despise creativity, but yet they're putting him on. They can't really be concerned with helping him out. Why is that? Maybe the guy's okay if he's in federal prison locked up that he believes a certain way, but when you and I believe in, you know, certain things and believe in, number one, the race issue above all things, they tend to get a little upset. So I've informed his mother that I think she may be dancing with the devil by letting those people use him. That doesn't mean I want anybody to quit writing him or supporting Matt, but most of these people would not touch creativity with a 10-foot pole. Anyhow, that's the story there. Well, it is time to go back to school, boys and girls. I know you probably get tired of this, but there's some things we need to know about if we're not going to make the same mistakes all over again by running off every time they beat the pan with a spoon and join the Army, join the Air Force, join every, you know, Merchant Marine or whatever, and get your ass shot off, or kill a whole bunch of other people that never aren't your enemies anyhow. So we need to know that war is not something that works out for the white race. I don't think you can show me any war that was not a war of absolute provable self-defense, a total invasion of your land. Any of the others are phony baloney and got millions of white people killed over and over and over again to the point where there's only been one war. It's like a 100 years war. All these wars just linked up. They went from one to the other. World War, you know, even from the Civil War to World War One to World War Two to Korea. All this stuff is linked together. So we've been at war now for 100 years, man. And what has it gotten the white race? Every time you have these wars, you dislocate populations. They move around. They're trying to escape the war. And so they come across the border into your territory, invade your territory, just a lot of just trying to survive. I mean, look at 700,000 Palestinians had to run out of Palestine back in the day. Why? Because the Jews went in there and invaded a couple of towns, and the people resisted, and they went house to house throwing hand grenades in, and panic ensued, and 700,000 people were on the move into all these other countries. So you wonder about immigration. Most of the immigration is caused by war and war profits. Now, if you'll notice that the generals, the retired generals, are all up there testifying to Congress and these committees about how we need to get boots on the ground, and I hate that term. In other words, men into these other countries. But what they don't tell you is most of these retired generals are up to their ass investing in war weapons of war. I've got some more information on that. Like this one general, shit, he's involved in about 10 weapons corporations. So they start the war, they fight the war, and they profit from the war. So anyhow, think of that while I'm reading this to you. I hope it don't take too long. I might have to do it in two sections. The Civil War was the result of a series of political crimes and blunders, which both sections of the country were equally guilty. It was not inevitable nor necessary to fight in order to abolish slavery. In every other country of the world, slavery had been abolished without war. The question of slavery had never been a party issue until after the Mexican War. But from then until the election of 1860, slavery was the leading political issue. During the war with Mexico, Wilmot of Pennsylvania offered what is known as the Wilmot Proviso, which provided that the territory acquired from Mexico should be closed to slavery. Although this bill was defeated in Congress, it brought up the question of further extension of slavery. At the time of the Mexican War, there were two national parties, the Whigs and the Democrats. These two parties embraced almost all of the people, and as both were strong in both sections of the United States, they tended to cement the union, for parties on a national basis tend to unify a nation, while sectional parties lead to disunion. The anti-slavery people and the moderates gravitated towards the Whig Party, while the pro-slavery people gravitated towards the Democratic Party. The Whigs elected General Zachary Taylor president in 1848, although he was a large slaveholder, of Louisiana, he was a moderate and was satisfactory to all groups and sections. I guess that meant he was a slave owner. He didn't beat his niggers. He had the support of Lincoln as well as the Southern Whigs. Soon after Taylor became president, Henry Clay proposed that the famous Compromise of 1850, the important features of which admit California as a free state, organize the remainder of the territory taken from Mexico without regard to slavery, abolish the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and pass a fugitive slave law to be enforced by the federal government. This compromise, although a Whig measure, was instrumental in killing the Whig Party. No party or section was satisfied with it. President Taylor opposed it, but his death before its passage brought to the presidency the Vice President Fillmore, who allowed it to become law without his signature. The provision that broke up the Whig Party was the strict fugitive slave law. Well, the only reason they should have had the fugitive slave law is to get the fugitive slaves on a boat and ship them back to Africa or the Caribbean or someplace. And anti-slavery Whigs repudiated their party. The idea of fugitive slaves was shocking to the best moral judgments of the time. Well, yeah, they should have just closed down the goddamn camps and plantations and shipped them out and then split up the land and distributed it to the small farmers. The leaders of moral sentiments, in other words, they should have nationalized this plantation system. Leaders of moral sentiment, ministers, poets, and reformers of every type advised disobedience. It was a dead letter because of the moral sentiment of the age was against it. You know, it's silly, you know. A lot of these people, it was okay to have plantations, capitalist plantations, prison camps, prison labor camps, but it was not nice to go chasing escaped slaves. The pro-slavery people did not like it because it was not enforced. Thus, the law was treated with contempt by both parties. So why have a law if it's not enforced, one way or the other? The Whig Party, which was moderate national, opposed to expansion and extension of slavery, was disrupted. Now, all these white people at the time, these leaders and other people, they could figure out what was going to happen, bringing more and more Negroes into this country, expanding these plantations, and breeding blacks like mad. They had to have known what would ultimately happen. So I don't give them an out at all. They're all enemies of the white race. Even the ones who wouldn't have anything to do with the black personally or socially, but allowing the expansion and carrying on of the slave trade and the plantation system made you just as bad as any race-mixing Jew. The Democrats carried all except four states in 1852 and remained in power until 1860, dominated by powerful pro-slavery sentiment throughout this period, which was simply make lots of money with free black labor. After the fall of the Whig Party, the Republican Party was organized in 1856. It took the name Republican from the followers of Thomas Jefferson and claimed it was a revival of the party of Jefferson. Of course, Jefferson owned, what, 200 or 300 slaves and was screwing one of them. It was the liberal party opposed to slavery. It was organized and until after Civil War dominated by the liberal element in the United States. Well, why would they say that when Jefferson was a full-blown slave owner who never freed? He only freed one slave, according to the records, on his deathbed. He didn't free any of the others. So how can the Republican Party take him on as their moral compass? You see how screwed up history is? You see how screwed up our white race has been for a long, long, long time. The Democratic Party also claimed themselves to be followers of Jefferson. You mean they all wanted a black girlfriend too? which they were not at that time, except in a very narrow legal sense. Jefferson was opposed to slavery and special privilege in every form. Remember one thing about Jefferson. In the height of the Revolutionary War, when Washington and the troops were starving to death at Valley Forge, hell of a lot of them didn't even have shoes, and they were wading around in the snow with bloody feet, Washington exclaimed loudly one day, he said, "Where in the hell is Jefferson?" Jefferson was sitting on by the fire down at Monticello in his big house, contemplating throwing in a towel. That's Jefferson. In 1800, he advocated states' rights or a decentralized government because he believed the states were and would always be more popularly controlled than the federal government. Well, I believe that too. Of course, that's a gamble. It can go get even worse, or it can get a lot better. That would be up to the people in the state. Say if Indiana became separated as a state in its own, it'd be up to people like myself and other people in the state to keep it right and get rid of the illegal aliens and encourage the blacks to move to Chicago. But by 1860, that situation was reversed. States, especially the southern states, had begun to be dominated by the privileged group, who talked in terms of states' rights to perpetuate this privilege, while Jefferson talked in terms of states' rights because he feared the domination of the federal government by the reactionary element. Well, you see, the only reason they wanted states' rights is to ensure that they're going to be able to keep having nigger plantations. That was it, not to be separate to get rid of blacks and ship them back out. Both Lincoln and Jefferson held the same views socially. The Democratic Party of the pre-Civil War period had repudiated Jefferson, but the Republican Party did not become reactionary until after the Civil War. When the Republican Party was organized in 1856, it was regarded as red, chiefly in the eyes of the South, for it was organized principally with the idea of keeping slavery out of the West, which was a good idea to keep it out of the West. Can you imagine how bad it would be today if we'd have had plantations all the way to the West Coast, and they tried to put them up into Oregon and Idaho too? His campaign literature in 1856 was composed largely of anti-slavery utterances of Jefferson. To the South, Republican, anarchy, abolitionist, Lincoln, John Brown, and Garrison were soon to become synonymous terms. See, the one thing you don't hear him talking about, at least the major propaganda books, of them saying, well, we want to free him, but we're going to send him back to Africa. You see hardly any of that talk going on. So they're going to free him and then still use him as cheap labor. Yeah. So they'll go from chattel slavery to wage slavery when those free slaves went into the North and got to working in the factories. That was wage slavery that the white man had been under for a long, long time. Because of this, the Republican Party had no following in the South, even among the great many people who wished to abolish slavery. It became a sectional party, which was its fatal weakness in dealing with slavery, as compared with the former Whig Party, which had a national following. The Republican Party was sectional until 1860. Lincoln had been a Whig and had accepted the Compromise of 1850. Although he was one of the great men of all times, I don't believe so, he was a victim of many of the common errors of his age. Reflecting the belief of his time, he considered slavery a stable institution. So if you consider it a stable institution, then you're pro-slavery. That he expressed the ideas of the common man and had complete faith in him. Do you have complete faith in the common man to save your race and battle for your race? I sure as hell don't. He tried to recognize and give expression to the purpose and aspirations of the masses. But remember, the masses are asses, which made him one of the world's greatest Democrats. with democracy's strengths and weaknesses. And then he turned around and formulated a dictatorship. Oh. Lincoln was not a creative thinker and had few pretensions in that direction. He had no intention of abolishing slavery in the states. He simply wished to prevent it from spreading. Well, he should have spread it right across the Atlantic back into Africa. Nobody's talking about that. He also held the common attitude of his age that the Negro belonged to an inferior race. Well, if you believe that, why wouldn't you be doing everything you could to get them out of the country? Get them off on their own playground. Because you were cowards, that's why. And there was too much money involved. In the election of 1860, Lincoln pulled only 26,430 votes in the entire South. Those were from the upper section. That would have been Kentucky, Tennessee, and places like that, where there wasn't much slavery going on. Douglas, the moderate Democrat, received 163,525 votes in the South. Bell of the Unionist Party received 525,973 votes in the same section, while Breckinridge, the extreme pro-slavery candidate, received 570,871 votes in the entire South. Breckinridge carried the lower South by a plurality, while Lincoln carried the West and the North by a plurality and was elected president. The Douglas and Bell voters of the South were opposed to secession, but all the secession vote went to Breckinridge, although not all the Breckinridge vote was for secession. A majority in the South opposed secession, but the Southern states fell into the hands of the secessionists by a plurality. Why did the South secede? Lincoln was elected on a platform defying the Dred Scott decision of 1857. According to this decision, the Constitution recognized slavery and therefore Congress could not prohibit it in the Western territories. That would have been beautiful if hundreds of thousands of niggers had been moved all the way west. This would be Nigeria today if it had been. This could be done only by the states through their constitutions or by the federal government through a constitutional amendment. This was a great legal victory for slavery, but it sure was not a victory for white working class, that's for sure. But Lincoln defied the decision and expected the next move on the part of the pro-slavery advocates to be an attempt to legalize slavery in the northern states through a Supreme Court decision. Wouldn't that have been ducky? Lincoln, when asked what he meant by saying the Union could not exist half free and half slave, said that slavery would eventually have to go, but it would probably last 100 years. Oh, jeez. He did not realize that slavery was dying. Well, it shouldn't have been that hard to see. This election of Lincoln on a platform of defying a decision of the Supreme Court caused the Lower South to secede as a gesture to uphold the courts and the Constitution. You see, this is all the property class, the ruling class in the South, which they were joined at the hip with the northern bankers and northern corporations. So much so that New York City threatened to secede long before the South. Lincoln coerced them in order to uphold the Constitution, for he had been legally elected president, and his office required his execution of federal laws. Thus, both the North and the South fought to defend the Constitution, which shows you right then the Constitution was deader than a doornail. Both felt themselves defensive. Neither section understood the other. I think they understood each other a lot more than what this man's saying. And emotionalism in the matter was so kindled that reason could not function on either side. You know, it's amazing how high a vote these guys got down South when they were screwing the white working man right out of his eye teeth. And he's stupid enough to go out and vote for the pro-slavery slate. Thus, both the North and the South fought to defend the Constitution. Both felt themselves defensive. neither section understood the other. I just read that. And emotionalism in the matter was so kindled that reason could not function on either side. The Civil War was a war about an abstraction. It was insanity is what it was. The status of slavery in the Western Territory, which was the real cause of the war. Was that cause to protect the white race? No, it was, the war was to protect the ruling class and the rich. Not take their profit away, not take their Negroes away from them. There were other differences between the North and the South, but none of them would have resulted in war had not the slave question entered into the conflict. By 1860, slavery in the greater part of the civilized world was a dead or dying institution. Great Britain, 1833, abolished slavery in all her possessions. Mexico provided for the gradual abolition of slavery as early as 1827. Brazil followed it in 1888, and Spain abolished slavery in Cuba in 1878. Well, the white people in Brazil, Spain, and the ruling class could see ahead and see what was happening. Brazil had many, 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 many more times the numbers of black slaves and blacks than we absorbed. If we'd have absorbed as many blacks as Brazil, this country would be almost totally black by now. And Spain abolished slavery in Cuba in 1878. And the Cubans know. Cuba, even up until Batista, there was a lot of racial segregation going on in Cuba. Nobody with Negro blood could get into any of the clubs of the ruling class. And all these, you know, they always want their cake and eat it too. They want to make all the money off these slaves, but they don't want to have them come into their club and have a drink. That's, of course, hypocrisy is the great sport of most white people. All the northern states of the Union had become free, and the western states and territories were repudiating slavery as well. When California drew up her constitution and asked for admission in 1850, the clause prohibiting slavery was adopted by a unanimous vote of her constitutional convention. In the referendum held in Kansas in 1858, 11,300 out of the total vote of 13,088 were opposed to slavery. See, the common people were opposed to slavery. But I wonder how many of the common people were prepared to vote to exclude them totally from American shores. Only a few slaves had been carried there, and they could never have been permanently held as slaves. New Mexico was organized as a territory in 1850, without regard to slavery, and at one time as many as 22 slaves had been carried there. Nevada, Colorado, Dakota were organized territories before 1860, but had no slaves. It was too cold for them. In Missouri, slavery was on the decrease. If judged by its percentages of the entire population, in 1830, 17.8% of the Missouri population were slaves. That's amazing, because allegedly the population of blacks in this country today is only 13%. It's higher than that, but still that's not too many. In 1850, 12.8%, and in 1860, only 9.8%. So Missouri was losing its slaves. Slavery would have existed in Missouri only for a few more years, for the anti-slavery population was increasingly rapid by settlers from the free states and great numbers of people from Germany who settled in the neighborhood of St. Louis and were especially opposed to slavery. See, these were the people that were fled the War of 1848 over there in Europe, of which a hell of a lot of them fueled the armies of the North against the South. Before 1860, slavery was non-existent in all sections of the Union except the tobacco, cotton, and sugarcane belts. Actually, sugarcane was the most damaging to our race. It still is. It's horrible. If the sugar lobby cannot be brought under control. There will be no white people able to defend themselves against anything. They'll be too fat, too out of shape. Sugar's a killer drug. In upholding the institution of slavery, the South was opposed to the spirit of the age. Slavery was doomed by moral and economic pressure. It was a useless procedure for the South to demand the right to carry slavery into the Western Territory because it was unprofitable economically and was not wanted. I don't see how they could have raised much cotton in the Northwest. For the same reason, it was futile for the opponents of slavery to try to prohibit by law its extension westward. The Westerners had no desire or use for it. It was this contention over slavery in the Western Territory which was the abstraction over which the Civil War was fought. Crazy these wars are. Many people before 1860 saw the fallacy of this controversy. Governor Robert J. Walker of Mississippi recognized the West would never be open to slavery, as did Stanton of Tennessee and Senator Toombs of Georgia. The status of slavery in the West had been automatically settled by the laws of nature. The two sections, however, cherished perverted ideas of each other. It was reported and actually believed in the South, in the North, that Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia had boastfully declared that he would call the roll of his slaves in Massachusetts. Well, this is another reason the United States, it was already too big. It should have not been. It should have been, the South one country, the North another country, probably. But more likely, more power into the states. If they were separated, they would not have the finances to wage war. They might wage some gun battles and things like that. But you see, the smaller state, independent from other states, would not have the finances to carry on war. That's one of the good reasons for that. The following incident, and of course people would recognize right away that their GNP in the state was not high enough to support war, and if anybody tried it to wage war on another state, pretty soon everybody would be going hungry in the streets. There just wouldn't be enough money excess. Only with federal concentration of power do you get that kind of money that you can afford. Well, you can't afford it, but you do go to war. The following incidents given in Macy's Political Parties in the United States, pages 209 to 211, are illustrative of the state of public excitement over the Civil War. In an effort to dictate the slave policy of the West, Charlie B. Lyons, a deacon of the New Haven congregation, had enlisted a company of 29 immigrants for the war. You see, there's the church. We don't have church separation of church and state. We never had separation of church and state. And these churches will go whichever the wind blows, most of them. A meeting was held in the church shortly before their departure for the purpose of raising funds, at which many clergymen and members of the Yale College faculty were present. The leaders of the party announced that Sharp's rifles were lacking and they were needed for self-defense. What's that got to do? I thought Christians were supposed to be peaceful, pacifists. There they're meeting in the church deciding what weapons to use. After an earnest address from Henry Ward Beecher, the subscription began. Professor Silliman started the subscription with one Sharp's rifle. The pastor of the church gave the second. 50 was the number wanted. Then Beecher announced that if 25 were pledged on the spot, Plymouth Church would furnish the rest. So here's the church right in the middle of raising money for weapons to go kill people, other white people. Don't forget that. They weren't gathering together to kill black people. They were gathering together to kill white people. Churches in both sections had by then become agencies for propagating hatred. Well, religion does propagate hatred. All you have to do is open up your Bible. It's all through the Bible. Hatred, hatred, kill them, annihilate them. Another incident is the number one. Another incident is a southern one. Colonel Buford of Alabama sold a number of his slaves valued at $20,000 and invested the money to equip a troop of 300 soldiers to fight for the Southern rights in Kansas. So they're all set, ready to go. The war has not even been declared. The day that Buford's battalion started from Montgomery, they marched to the Baptist church. You see, there you go, Christian church. The Methodist minister solemnly invoked a divine blessing on the enterprise. The Baptist pastor gave Buford a finely bound Bible and said that a subscription had been raised to present each immigrant with a copy of the Holy Scripture before he marched off to kill white people. I added that. This battalion left for the West armed with the Bibles and Sharp's rifles. That's a good combination. The existence of such a condition was excitement, made it an easier matter to participate in war. I don't see anybody trying to keep people from warring. I don't see any Christian church saying, I think war is bad. I think war is wrong. The baby Jesus wouldn't like war. Maybe he did. I guess he does. In political contests, the natural tendency is for persons of extreme views to gain leadership. Decided and partisan convictions are easily described and understood, whereas people of moderate and discreet judgment often lack conviction themselves and so cannot very well impress their views upon the masses. Garrison's extreme abuse of the South was met with similar other extremes. The abolitionists had great sympathy for the oppressed, but great hatred for the oppressor, and regarded the slave owner as personally responsible for slavery rather than an agent of circumstances. Perhaps if the abolitionists had directed their appeal to the moral conscience of the South, avoiding sectional and personal abuse, secession would never have taken place. No, I think generally people like war. They don't want to get hurt. They don't want to get bombed. But I think people are war lovers. Now, you may argue with me about that, but just look. It doesn't take that much, a little bit of propaganda lies, and they're off and running. The South meant this abuse by demanding that all anti-slavery publications be excluded from the mails. There you go. There goes the Constitution and your Bill of Rights of even the Confederacy out the window. Books, papers, and all publications suspected of containing anti-slavery propaganda were taken from the mails and publicly burned at Charleston, South Carolina, as was the book I've got here about the guy who was trying to get the slaves freed and then ship them back to Africa, which was a very popular book at the time. There were many manifestations of disregard for the sanctity of the mails. The North judged the South by these extreme actions, and the efforts of the South to suppress anti-slavery agitation resulted only in greater propaganda for the abolitionists. Public is quick to demand war, but is not so willing to accept its hardships. During the conflict, it was necessary for both North and the South to suspend civil liberties, including freedom of the press and speech, thus a dictatorship. Expressions that might weaken war morale were punished. Both sections suspended the writ of habeas corpus and arbitrarily imprisoned their citizens. About 38,000 people were imprisoned in the North, while the number in the South is unknown. Both sections, as in all major wars, resorted to the draft to recruit soldiers. Yet with all these weapons at their disposal, the Northern Army succeeded in enlisting only about 1,325,000 of its native white population out of a total of 23 million, besides approximately 1.325 million native whites. The Northern Army consisted of 300,000 whites from the South, 186,000 Negroes, and 500,000 foreigners. Left to the voluntary support of its citizens, neither section could have carried on the war, as no major war of modern times could have been fought with that voluntary support alone. You see, The people, the draft acts of both sexes allowed for the employment of substitutes, which of course was hard on the poorer classes who could employ substitutes. But the richer classes often avoided army service by this method. I think it ran about $1,500 to get out of the war in New York. I don't know what it was anyplace else. It is impossible to obtain an exact figure for the number of substitutes employed. You know, you hire some guy to go off and die for you. But the Secretary of War under Davis considered 50,000 a low estimate for the Confederate Army in 1864. Desertion was frequent on both sides. I don't blame them. A la outlaw Josie Wales. No, he didn't desert. He fought in the war, and then after the war moved west. Rhodes estimates the number of deserters in the South at 100,000 in 1864. There's a good movie on that. I forget the title, where these guys are sent out under the Union Army and so forth to bring these guys, or under the Southern Army, to bring these guys back that deserted. It was an ongoing thing, and they just shot him. Much has been heard of the heroism and sacrifice displayed during the conflict, but little of the crimes committed by both sections. Only the pleasant phases of the war have survived. When Joseph Holt and Robert Dale Owen were appointed by Secretary of War Stanton to adjust claims for materials supplied to the War Department, they found fraud at every turn, and before making their final report in July 1862, secured deductions of nearly $17 million from claims amounting to $50 million. One claim alone was reduced $1 million, and another was reduced $580,000. One senator had received $10,000 for securing an order from the War Department for a client, Colonel Henry S. Olcott, who appointed special commissioner to investigate frauds after a thorough examination of the facts, announced that from 20% to 25% of the expenditures of the federal treasury during the Civil War was tainted with fraud, and according to his estimate, approximately $700 million was paid through fraud. See, nothing changes. You know, everybody said, well, let's go back to the old days. It's always been that fraud and deceit and war is used to rob the people, and the people go right along with it, and they still do today. And if you ask most right-wing guys that are in the Klan today, what little Klan is left, oh yeah, I want to go there and kill those ragheads, you know. In commenting upon moral conditions during the conflict, the Springfield Republican said editorially, quote, it is a sad and shocking picture of life in Washington, which our correspondents are giving us. A Bureau of the Treasury Department made a home of seduction and prostitution. The necessities of the poor and pretty women made the means of their debauchery by high government officials. Members of Congress putting their mistresses into clerkships in the departments. Whiskey drinking ad libitum. These are some of the typical incidents of the condition in both sections. But textbooks in treating this war, as of all others, present only those phases which glorify war. The cost of the Civil War, including the expenditures of both sections, pensions, destructions of property, and other indirect expenses, was $12 billion in Civil War dollars. Its damage to the morale and spiritual development of the United States cannot be estimated, and it's still not over. And that's the end. There's some good books you should read. Political Parties in the United States, 1846 to 1861. History of the United States, volumes 1 through 5. W.E. Dodd, Cotton Kingdom. We have that on our website that you can download. Jesse Macy, The Anti-Slavery Crusade. N.W. Stevenson, The Day of the Confederacy, Stevenson, also Abraham Lincoln and the Union, William Wood, Captain of the Civil War, W.L. Fleming, the sequel to Appomattox. So anyhow, you have it there, and so it's just more of the same. graft, corruption, treason, big business making lots of money. And so don't come to me and say this all just started. Back in the Civil War and back beyond that, these are all honest wars and honest people and honest politicians. Bullshit. The founding fathers were corrupt as hell. And ever since then, the so-called people who run the show are corrupt as hell. And if you don't understand that, you're going to keep making the same mistake and you're not going to help the white race at all. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, 14:05, and shut up. Wait a minute. I think I've got something else tomorrow. Just a second. All right, tomorrow I'll cover the fiasco with Spain, the war between the U.S. and Spain, another one of those fake wars and sinking that battleship Maine and Havana Harbor and all that, just like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and all that kind of crap. It's all crap, man, and if you follow that kind of stuff, and if you're some kind of a super patriot, you're nuts. You're either patriotic to your race or you're nothing.
Hey, this is going to be exciting. We're about to interview a real live anarchist. I'm not kidding. So I think we have our connection now to this real live anarchist, presumably hiding in some anti-government compound somewhere. Real live anarchist, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Wow. And are you really and truly an actual anarchist?
Yes, I am.
And are you... wait a second, I'm being told that we have some problems with the audio and video connection. Well, we'll just keep going and see what happens. Now, to protect your identity, how about if I just call you Anarchist X?
Well, you could just call me Tessa.
Tessa? Is that some secret code name? Like an acronym for terrorist, extremist, scary...
No, it's just my name, Tessa Rose.
Oh. Okay. Well, let's see. I have a few questions here. Number one, do you prefer pipe bombs or Molotov cocktails?
I don't know anything about either, and I don't have any use for either.
Oh. Well, what's the most recent terrorist action you participated in?
I've never participated in any terrorist action. Why would I?
Well, as an anarchist, you're a big fan of violence and chaos, right?
No, I'm a big fan of peaceful coexistence.
But you're an anarchist. Don't you want to violently overthrow the government?
No, I want people to choose voluntary interaction and stop using what they call government to extort and control each other.
But aren't you hoping for some sort of Mad Max type of existence, every man for himself?
No, I want people to find voluntary ways to cooperate and organize for mutual benefit, on a voluntary basis without coercion.
But you're an anarchist. Aren't you for survival of the fittest and might makes right?
No, where do you get these ideas? I want people to understand and abide by the non-aggression principle. Never initiate violence against each other on your own or by way of politics. Actually, it's people who advocate government who seem to think that it's okay to control your neighbors as long as you do it by way of law.
But as an anarchist, aren't you against all rules? Don't you want lawless mayhem?
Why would anyone want lawless mayhem? People have moral rules inside their own heads. It's called conscience. I want them to pay attention to that and listen to that instead of doing what politicians tell them to do.
But if everyone just followed his own conscience and moral code, wouldn't we be robbing and attacking and killing each other like wild beasts?
Very few people have a moral code that calls for that. Most people want to live in peace and cooperation. If you look at the large-scale injustices in history, they're all the result of people carrying out the will of authority and government.
Well, okay, I guess what the Nazis did was enacted into law and done in the name of authority and government. And same with the regime of Stalin and Mao and Lenin and Pol Pot and Franco, Saddam, Chavez, Castro, Idi Amin, Chiang Kai-shek, Kim Il-sung, Mussolini. But I mean, if we didn't have some government, wouldn't roving gangs of thugs take over the world?
That's very unlikely. In this country, about 100 million people own guns. The only gang that could extort and control these people is one that they believe has the authority to do so. In other words, government. Any gang that tried to do that by brute force alone would quickly fail.
So do you just trust that everybody would be good and nice if there wasn't government?
Certainly not. There will always be a certain number of sociopathic people in the population. As long as those people are just acting on their own, we can defend ourselves against them. It's when they get into government that they get really dangerous.
But what if your neighbors decide to rob you or control you?
All my neighbors who believe in government already try to rob and control me by way of government, by voting for politicians. In contrast, none of my neighbors have ever tried to rob me on their own because they feel it's wrong. But they imagine it's okay to do it by way of government.
But doesn't the government need to tax you in order to protect you?
Protect me from what? The government has robbed me continually throughout my life. The government has invaded my house and my privacy and imprisoned me. And no one else has. Who are they protecting me from? Government may protect us from a tiny amount of private theft and thuggery, but then it legitimizes theft and thuggery on a huge scale. That's not a good trade-off.
Okay, the government controls and taxes us a lot, but if we didn't have any government, I mean, who would save us from all the nasty people? Wouldn't we be left defenseless?
We're not defenseless. We each have the right to defend ourselves, and we can cooperate to defend ourselves collectively.
But isn't that what government is?
No. A voluntary organization doesn't claim to have any special rights, just the rights that everyone in it has. Governments claim to have rights that the rest of us don't have.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about free market protection companies, but wouldn't private security companies just take over and become the new government?
Throughout history, people have overthrown authoritarian regimes and replaced them with other authoritarian regimes. That's why the answer isn't political, it's philosophical. People have to stop imagining that legal aggression is necessary or legitimate. Once they understand that, no one will be able to control or oppress them again.
So even though you're an anarchist, you don't even want to overthrow the government?
Not really. Too many people still believe in it and depend on it. Overthrowing it would just cause chaos, and it would just be replaced with another one. The problem is in people's heads, and the solution is in people's heads, too. Stop believing that government has any authority over you. Stop paying attention to it, and eventually it will cease to exist.
Well, one more thing. On the news, we hear about anarchists breaking things and having violent protests and threatening people. That isn't what you're about?
No. I don't know how much the media exaggerates or just makes up, or how much the government instigates these things just to blame them on anarchists. Society will always have a few destructive punks, but thinking anarchists, also called voluntarists, are not about violence and destruction.
So one can be an anarchist without being a malcontent, bomb-chucking punk?
Yes, of course. People who actually understand the problem know it can't be fixed by breaking windows and yelling slogans. The way to achieve peace and justice is to have people give up the superstitions of government and authority and embrace self-ownership and non-aggression.
So you're not pushing for violent revolution, you just want to change the way people think?
Yes. I just want people to understand that peaceful social coexistence requires a voluntary, stateless society. A world of equals with no masters and no slaves. A world in which you're free to live your own life, spend your own money, make your own choices, and pretty much do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anybody else. That's free and peaceful coexistence.
Well, you're obviously a dangerous, violent, hateful extremist kook, so I'm ending this interview.
Well, anarchy comes in all forms, but it's sure a long distance between the anarchists of the turn of the last century and before the last century than what she's espousing. I think it's her ideas are a little bit delusional considering the human animal. And she plays down the amount of so-called thuggery that's out there, lurking in the shadows, waiting for the best time to jump on you and take what you've got. And it's sort of a combination of the street thuggery and the government. It's a control mechanism, but I believe her form of anarchy sounds a little bit more like a liberal Democrat. Anyhow, I just thought I'd run that for you, see what you think. 14-5, and we're out of here.